So thanks, Susan. And as Susan said, this is very appropriate because I began my career being highly interested in insect metamorphosis and development, and then moved on into host pathogen interaction immunity. I've been working with bees for about 10 years looking at interactions and using viruses as a model. In the last year, I felt like I have undergone a complete metamorphosis, have been pulled out of my ivory tower and out into the real world where I didn't think I had existed in ivory tower before. So I changed my title here because I feel I need to try today. We'll see how well I do. Those of you who've heard me talk before, I'm going to try something completely different to try to impassion you and convince you on how important this is. And before I begin, I need to acknowledge that this is the effort of a very large group of researchers that have come together. So there's multiple people at these universities that have been working together, and USDA ARS, and Florida Department of Ag, Pennsylvania Department of Ag. And we've also recently pulled together to get the CAPS grant with multiple researchers across the country. On the pathogen discovery I'll mention here, there has been a bigger team, and we have to thank the people at Columbia University that joined us. They're actually medical germ hunters that came on board, and they brought with them the 454 Life Sciences Corporation that does pyro sequencing that will allow us to do some discovery. And then within my own lab, I have to thank these people for some of the data I'm going to share with you. And of course, funding's extremely important. So Pennsylvania Department of Ag has been exceptionally good to my lab in funding us, USDA Critical Issues, National Honey Board, Haagen-Dazs has been good to Penn State. And then for a lot of the research on colony collapse disorder, the NIH has actually contributed through their funds that Ian Lipkin had and these others here. So way back when I began undergraduate as an entomology major, basically we were told that pollinators were good, that they were out there, and that there had been this coevolution of plants and pollinators, and that there was this sort of contract in place. But even through graduate school, there wasn't that much known or emphasized about. We sort of took them for granted, and I know from my own history in academia as a faculty member, many universities have lost or eliminated their positions in apiculture. And as I'll tell you, we've sort of ignored a crisis that has been developing. And this goes way back to our early association with bees. As humans, bees have been one of our livestock from the very beginning. Back in cave paintings, you can find people collecting honey, utilizing it. The Egyptians have hieroglyphics carved on their tombs. Many different countries, such as India, have goddesses of honeybees that they have been revered and worshipped. The colonists also brought honeybees over with them, along with many of their plants. And in the expansion of the world here, the honeybee, Apis mellifera, is the primary pollinator throughout the world. So it is truly the insect livestock of the world, that we maintain it, we manage it, and keep it going. But it's much more than just honey now. It's pollination as well. So as you've heard, there's over 100 different crops in the United States that are dependent upon pollination, primarily by honeybees. And a few years ago, this was valued at $14.6 billion. Mike Perella at Davis has told me that the value of that in almonds right now exceeds that tremendously. So it doesn't include the other things, including in soybeans, where for some cultivars you can get a 10% increase in yield by pollination, which may have great implications for biofuels. So the bee products, the honey and the wax, are sort of the icing on the cake here for many of the beekeepers. And the pollination is important because you either, without it, don't get any yield, or in the case of apples, you're going to get fruit that are deformed, are going to grade out lower, and be of much lower value to the grower. This is what I didn't realize until 2007, where we've gone. That we now have, in the US, a relatively small number of beekeepers that have over 2,000 colonies. The largest beekeeper has up to 60, 70,000 colonies. And these are our mobile pollination units. We've gone from having small farms, each having their own apiary, to having monoculture of crops, and now we have to truck in. In Central Valley of California, prior to almond, we now have to bring in half the bee colonies in the United States to pollinate that crop that will be blooming there. It's estimated that in the next few years, it's going to require twice as many colonies as we currently have. These are our healthy estimates of our colonies than what we have right now. So we are having a great demand here. So what you see in this picture, each of these little white boxes here, is actually a pallet, a wooden pallet that has upon it four different colonies. And so they bring these in large numbers and to go into the almonds. And if you look here, the reason why they are needed is quite clear. There are no other plants growing in the almond orchards. There's no native bees that can be found within these orchards. So we have to bring in the honeybees. And the beekeepers who bring it in have to get their colonies graded for certain strength of the number of workforce of bees that are present there. The price of that pollination, what the beekeeper charges, has greatly increased, so that now it's up to 160, and probably Glory can tell me if that may even go higher. But it's incredible value, such that some beekeepers in California find that their colonies are disappearing in the middle of the night, that they're actually stolen and taken away. So it is a high-value industry here. So each almond here requires at least one bee to visit it. But this is no longer guaranteed, and this has been occurring over time, even before colony collapse disorder ensued. So if you look back here in 1945, we had a fairly large number of colonies in the U.S., and it declined over time, mainly due to the advent of American fowl brood, and then people just moving away from that tradition. And then in the 1980s is when two major parasites, the tracheal mite and varroa mites, were introduced. From there on, it has been a battle for beekeepers to keep their colonies healthy. We've shown in our lab that the little mite here, the varroa mites, actually knock out the immune systems of the bees, making them much more susceptible to diseases. So in some parts of the U.S., we see that you lose over 40% of your colonies during the winter just due to this mite alone. And that's where beekeepers have started using various types of chemical controls like Kumafos, fluvalinate. The mites, of course, have developed resistance, so these chemicals are no longer effective. And many of the beekeepers that we surveyed who had colony collapse disorder, we did it under human subject protection, where they could tell us honestly what they were doing and we would not convey the information back. We learned that they now have to, or feel like they have to, resort to other control measures. All of those were use of insecticides that are not registered whatsoever here. And there was no commonality in chemicals or the way that they did it. So Dave Hackenberg here, he's actually a Pennsylvania beekeeper. He's the first one here, and we have to give him a lot of credit because he drew the attention here, drew a lot of flack by other beekeepers for it. But he, in the fall of 2006, had what he thought were extremely healthy, strong colonies. 2 weeks later showed up, and almost all of them were missing adult bees inside the colony and had a queen and large number of brood in place. So with colony collapse disorder, we now define it as the absence of dead bees in the colony. When the bees are there, you find that they appear to be young. The queen is present, she hasn't gone anywhere, and that you usually have a fair amount of brood. But what you see here is there's nobody left to take care of it. Having that brood there meant that that colony had been very strong just a short time prior to that. So how bad is it getting? This last spring, we've had our second round of colony collapse disorder. It appears to be seasonal, and right now is when we expect to start hearing some reports starting to come in. They'll go through the spring and then probably cease to happen through the summer. In 2006-2007, we estimated 25% of all beekeepers in the United States had experienced some type of colony collapse disorder. This new estimate, based upon a survey that was done by Apiary Inspectors of America and USDA, we have a 37% of all the beekeepers in the U.S. experiencing it, and that accounts for 60% of all the dead out colonies. The average loss there was 40.8% as compared to 17.1%, but this loss here is within an operation. So this is a business, and many of these people, this is their livelihood, and the loss can go anywhere from 35% on up to 80% loss. And so having that degree of loss is fairly devastating. And what we're concerned about is that this cannot keep occurring year after year, that these guys are just going to go out of business, and we don't see others standing in the wings wanting to take this over to manage this livestock that we have. So one of the big questions people keep saying, well, it's got to be the migratory operation. It's very stressful. And it's true that we've learned that it is stressful. It's associated with extra deaths of colonies. But what we found was it didn't matter how big your operation was. And if you had 1 to 50 colonies, 50 to 500, over 500 colonies, you had the same level of die-off. It didn't matter if they were migratory or stationary. It didn't matter if they went for honey production or if they went for pollination. And also, the few organic beekeepers that we have in the United States have also, some of them reported colony collapse disorder. So what is it? This is another picture here. This is in Central Valley as well. And these little white things that you see scattered across the valley going all the way out here, those are these bee colonies here. So if you look at within a CCD yard of an operation versus non-CCD, there's a big difference in mortality. But if you ask, is there association between a dead colony with another one or a weak colony with another one, we find that there's a huge odds ratio that if you're weak, your neighbor's going to be weak, or if you're dead, your neighbor's going to be dead. There's something there that in proximity defines that. Of course, the first thing that comes to mind there is that it's got to be a pathogen. So bees, as I mentioned, have lots of parasites, the varroa mite here and the tracheal mite. But just like us, they have a lot of different diseases. We find that they're bacterial diseases, American foul brood, European foul brood. As I'll tell you in a little bit, we find that there's a ton of viruses, many more viruses in bees than we know of any other insect. We also have Nosema, two different varieties, Nosema apis, Nosema serrani, and we have fungi such as chalk brood or stone brood, which is Aspergillus. These honeybee viruses, there have been historically described at least 18 different bee viruses. They're all RNA viruses and very tiny. You have to see them with an electron microscope. Most of them are related to picornal-like viruses, and so what are those? Picornal-like viruses include things like polio and foot and mouth disease virus. We find that there are picornal-like viruses that infect us and other mammals. There's viruses that infect plants, and then there's viruses that infect insects. So these 18 bee viruses here primarily include those, and they were identified by primarily a lab that no longer exists in England, the lab of Bailey and Ball, and they were done where they isolated and made antibodies and determined that they were very different. They got these viruses from localized die-outs that had occurred around the world. Right now, that information on those 13 other viruses that are not listed here has been lost. We know the name, but we do not have the antibodies. We don't have the viral isolates anymore. But we know they're out there somewhere. So I want to impress upon you that fact. Here in the US, we now know that we have these viruses. Sacbrood virus was here long before varroa mite. These others showed up after varroa mite came in. We don't know if the mite brought it in or if they drew it there at what we found as a latent or persistent infection, not causing obvious symptoms. The newest one here is this Israeli acute paralysis virus I'll tell you more about later. So with CCD, as you know, we've been doing a lot trying to ask about causes. We've gotten rid of a lot of hypotheses, so aliens and whatnot went out the door pretty early on, cell phones. We also have clear-cut evidence that GMOs are not part of the problem. We know that bees, right now, that they like corn pollen, and it doesn't matter if it has BT toxin in it or not. They like it. So we don't think that that is part of the problem, and that's been thoroughly tested. It's two very good research projects here. So the top three hypotheses that are still up there, even after a year, are one, the environmental chemicals impacting bees and triggering CCD, combination of stresses, and the primary stress here that we're considering is a nutritional stress, and then lastly, is there anything new or reemerging pathogens out there? So I'd like to show you some of the new data here that has come out with pesticides. And the surprises are here is that when you collect incoming pollen or if you look at adult bees brood in a colony, we find that there's huge amounts there that we never anticipated. There's up to 31 different pesticides. This is the primary parent compounds in a sample, and on an average, six different compounds in a colony. And there were only three samples out of over 400 different samples taken at this point in time that lacked anything whatsoever. out of these pesticides, the number of pesticides that are there, different kinds, is incredible. There's 73 different pesticides and 9 other metabolites. And this includes the range of all the different compounds that are out there, all the different chemistries, including ones that should have disappeared a long time ago, the organochlorines. They're being detected coming into the colonies. And we know that out of these, at least 14 of these are systemic pesticides. That is, when you apply it to the plant or the crop, it's going to be translocated, move up through the plant, and get localized into the nectar or into the pollen. But what we found is that there's no association with CCD at any point right now. So the other aspect here was that what I need to tell you, and one of the big black boxes that nobody wanted to tackle, was what's in honey. Because obviously, if you find something in honey, it's going to have devastating effects in people's perception on the healthiness of honey and how good it is for you. It's going to change. USDA and EPA have partnered to do this very delicate political action. They've taken multiple samples and have assayed it. And as right now, honey is free of any pesticides. And honey's been added into the American Market Basket Survey as a food item to be analyzed each and every year in the future. So that is great, because up to this point it hadn't been included. This is a list of the actual chemicals in here, for those of you interested. So you'll notice up here there's also some like aldecarb. The aldecarb here showed up in samples that came out of Florida. In Florida, they have a Section 18 for the citrus orchards to help control citrus greening disease, and have been able to use insecticides that had been pulled off the market. One thing that was alarming is that in the samples that contained this aldecarb in the pollen, the concentrations exceeded human toxicity levels. And so there have been a lot of political interactions, and I feel like I can tell you this one. Is that many of these detections were reported back, as you should, to the chemical companies, to EPA, and also to the state of Florida. This detection in here, basically, the regulatory agencies say, well, we don't think this is of importance right now, because it's not showing up in the honey, it's not showing up in the oranges, and our advisors tell us not to worry about it. Unfortunately, the advisors are the people who are directly selling the compound here, and not scientists who are advising on toxicology. So there are problems in here in conveying how concerned we are about these pesticides. So at this point in time, we do think that these environmental pesticides are not just CCD, they're one of those potential stressors out there that could weaken bees, but we have a major concern for pollinator health in general, that if bees are finding them, we're sure that the other pollinators are also finding them. In terms of habitat nutrition, we have concerns right now. Many of these beekeepers, when they move their bees from one area to another area, are feeding their bees. I've learned that Dave Hackenberg routinely buys over 10 railroad cars full of sugar syrup every year to feed his bees. And he's going into areas that are fairly lush and green, like Pennsylvania or New York and that. And it's pretty amazing how he feeds them. It's like a 50-gallon barrel that's put into the ground at a slant, puts straw on top, and the bees just come and go, huge numbers in that. But some of these areas, there's nothing there. Like I showed you in the beginning of Central Valley, there's no flowers in bloom when those bees end up in the area there. But there's also concern what's happening in everyday summer. If you look at this area here, which could be Pennsylvania, it looks pretty lush and green. But if you look, there's very little field hedgerows. And around the houses, we see there's lots of nice lawn here, but you don't see much in terms of wildflowers. You don't see the flowering weeds. And so this is what the pollinators see. Basically a desert area here. There's nothing to eat, nothing to live on. So we have a concern that because of how we've changed our environment and our way of growing things, even our own yards, we've created this desert for the pollinators, and that we need to do something about it. Okay, so now on to the disease side. So as many of you know, we did the original investigation, took samples from CCD operations. We had healthy samples in our freezer, and basically tore them apart, looking at all the genetic material there. And the honeybee genome was critical for this, because what it allowed us to do is extract the bee genes from this and look at anything else that was foreign. We published this in Science in 2007. We had also looked at Australian imports, and royal jelly that we knew was being used by queen breeders. We found in these bees a lot of things that we didn't know existed before, so some bacteria that we think are symbionts. We found some fungi, some of which may be of concern. We found the different Nosema, and we also found a brand new virus, this Israeli acute paralysis virus. The Israeli acute paralysis virus at that time was a good predictor of CCD. We didn't claim it was a causal agent. It was found in 96. If you saw it, it was about 96 prediction that you had CCD. And if you had these other four pathogens here, you got 100% prediction. So this virus was first identified in Israel in 2004 by Ilan Sala. We know that we found it in CCD samples. We also found it in the Australian packages. We found it in the royal jelly from China. And there's great potential for worldwide distribution based upon reanalysis of some of the sequences that are in the gene bank, the database for where molecular data is put in. We also now have confirmed that it's in France, Canada, and Spain. So one of the questions was, how long has IAPV been in the United States? How many different strains were there? And then could we go in and replicate CCD symptoms with it? So the IAPV has been in the United States since at least 2002. And when we look at the virus sequence and compare the sequences, we find that there's at least three different strains. One strain correlates with the sequences from Israel and other new samples. One strain correlates with East Coast here. The other strain correlates with West Coast and the Australian packages. These are a perfect match. We have actually two sources of bees from Australia, two independent importers, and their viruses are the same here. So we do say that indeed this strain came in from Australia. The one on the East Coast is not as clear where it came from. The potential there is for it to have come in with the royal jelly. Perhaps it was being used in queen breeding. But we've also found it in small hive beetle, which is a pest in the bees themselves. And the reason why we think that that might actually be real is that when small hive beetle came in 2002 the U.S., it was particularly devastating where it came in. But the review articles, if you read them, say, why is this? If you look at this beetle and look at its genetics, it matches the beetle that's over here in this other country. That's not causing any problem. What's the difference here? So it could have been that this virus was actually brought in and vectored by small hive beetle. It's also possible that the well-intentioned beekeeper who saw a queen that he really liked when he visited another country and stuck it in her pocket in a little box with a few workers may have brought it in. So we need to get out to these beekeepers that we have this reason for importation barriers on purpose. We do know that in 2004 it was not widely distributed. We couldn't find it from samples that we had obtained from Louisiana, from Arizona, thanks to Gloria and others from Africanized bees and also European bees that were there. We could not find it in Pennsylvania queens that we had gotten from and workers from other colonies around the state, our survivors in Georgia packages. We did find it in one colony that was in Florida that appeared to not have any CCD at that point in time. We didn't know what happened to this colony after we sampled it. So what does IAPV do? So at Penn State for the last year, I've had a greenhouse that has four different rooms in it. We've tried to seal it up to create containment. We've brought in the bees in there from both Hawaii, which lacks any IAPV, lacks varroa mites. We've gotten bees from Georgia that have KBV. And then what we've done is we've given them KBV on some of the rooms that we've given virus by feeding it to them. In the control rooms here, we just give them straight sugar water. In these rooms, we're feeding them Mega Bee, which they like, but it's probably not a complete nutrition without any having any pollen whatsoever in there. So the bees are under stress in just being in the greenhouse. And then we have given them IAPV and looked at what occurred. So we've counted the number of dead bees. So being in a greenhouse, these bees cannot escape. They can't go elsewhere to disappear like we see in the field with CCD. So we've gridded our room and we've looked to quantitate where the bees are dying. If they're dying along the borders of the room where they'd be bashing themselves against the windows, or if they're dying across the center at random patterns. And what we can see is that there isn't a difference in the die-offs before the virus, but after the virus, we see a fairly rapid die-off when we give the Israeli acute paralysis virus. especially along the borders and then across the center of the room, that these die-offs are not associated with a colony. These bees are dying out across the room. And when we look at these dead bees, and since we can find them there, or the dying bees, we see this twitching, these paralytic type motions here. But we don't see that with KBV. So we do think that even these closely related viruses, that we have very distinct symptoms here. So our conclusion right now is that IAPV is indeed a very pathogenic virus. We also have been looking at transmission routes. So with these viruses, we have a lot of transmission routes. Vertical transmission, if the queen's infected, it goes through the eggs. If the workers are infected, they can transmit it into all the foods in the colony via the salivary secretions. It's been demonstrated this last year that if you have an infected drone or semen and you artificially inseminate the queen or mate with the queen, that queen will become infected. You have sexually transmitted diseases. The viromites can also become infected and can vector the viruses. But we were seeing transmission with IAPV much quicker. Accidentally, we brought in new packages and brought them to some of our experiment colonies, and we found the virus in the new packages and it moved over to our experimental colonies in 2-week period of time. So with my graduate students, especially Rajwinder Singh, who talked about this the other day, we now have evidence that the pollen itself is a vehicle for transmission, that we can find foragers bringing in pollen, take off that pollen ball, detect the virus that's in that pollen ball, but the forager is completely uninfected. And we also now have evidence that this is not just honeybee viruses, that these viruses can infect all the other hymenopter pollinators, so bumblebees, solitary bees, and wasps. We've gone in and we sequenced these viruses from both the foragers, the pollen balls, and these native species. And what we see is that foragers are scattered across this tree here. We can see the pollen balls likewise, the viruses in them are scattered across. And then we can see that some of them, indeed the virus strain that the bee's carrying matches what's in her pollen ball. But the most majority of them, and I'm only showing two here, is that you have dissimilar sequences. And then lastly, the non-apis pollinators are scattered across here. This is extremely good evidence that these viruses are freely flowing among this community here. We also have samples that we've taken from CCD apiaries, these native bees, and we have found IAPV there. We did not find IAPV in the native bees in our normal research apiaries that are free of the virus. And so this is of concern. What is this virus going to do to those species? So obviously we're out there watching the honeybees, but who is watching these others, observing where they're dying and where they're going? So this is of concern. As you know, in 2006, and there was released this publication by the National Academy of Science. May Barenbaum was the editor, saying that there was a decline in population sizes and species of pollinators in the United States for all of them, and that we have had several extinctions occur in bumblebees. There's additional reports of extinctions in bumblebees. We also know that you can have pathogen spillover of some of the Nosema from managed colonies of bumblebees into wild bumblebees. So it raises the question, what's going on and how is what's happening in honeybees going to show up in these others? It's not just the United States, but it's also a worldwide concern. So there are published declines of pollinators and pollination in these countries. Some of the countries in Europe, Israel, India, Taiwan, China, and Australia. So I heard through a chief virologist to China that they did have CCD, and a friend here confirmed that this summer that she had actually seen the media reports that there were extensive die-offs and that the symptoms are very close match CCD. Australia, even this summer, said that they had a major die-off, that one of the beekeepers had lost 70% of his bees. Unfortunately, at the end of the article, said he was one of the exporters to the United States. So, anyway. But the dramatic thing is, learning about this situation that's occurred in Sichuan, China, in this one valley. There are no pollinators in this valley whatsoever. There are no native bees, there are no honeybees. And there's been two reports. This one has come from a center that looks at pollination in bees in the entire area, multi-country areas. And The Silence of Bees, which is a documentary done by Partisan Picks that I'd recommend if you haven't seen it. It's exceptionally good, it'd be great for classes. But they went to this area. What these people do there to get pollination in their full-size pear trees is they collect flowers, dry the plant, take the anthers, remove the pollen by mortar and pestle, and go out with feather dusters and climb into the trees to hand pollinate each and every of those flowers. That's how they have to generate the fruit. That's what they were showing for the squashes. And so that's the only way they're doing it. They're saying that even there, at this point in time, there it's hard to find people willing to do that. So State Department and FAO, you can find on their websites that they recognize that pollination, having healthy pollination, is required for political stability. So I've actually been asked to go speak at State Department this last year, and to people that didn't have any listing of government agency, and I asked what they did, and they said intelligence. So so why should we care? Each of us needs to care, because one out of every three bites we eat every day, we have to thank the bees. And as we, as entomologists, we know now what pollinators mean to the ecosystem. We cannot be entomologists if we lose pollinators, unless you want to study corn insects for the rest of your life. So we have this dependence of there. So what can we do? And I'd like to try to do this activism here, that as a department, we have to ensure that each and every student that passes through our classroom doors knows about pollinators and the crisis. It can't be like it was back when I was getting trained, that you just sort of get this nice little lecture and it goes on and you never really learn. And I think as scientists, we have to become activists. So this is where I'm going on a limb for me. We have to have a change in regulations. APHIS right now is blocking the importation of additional stocks of bees from other countries, but they want to consider it, but they're also allowing bee semen in it. It's important to get additional genetic diversity in the country, but when we ask how they're screening the semen for diseases, they say, well, we just look at the colony and see if they're healthy. So the question is, what about these other 13 viruses that we don't know how to go look for? How are they going to determine that it's not there? This is a vehicle of transmission, so we need to try to get APHIS to change this, to say that you have to do a molecular screening of that semen or any other bee stocks that they want to bring in to determine it's free. We also need to put pressure on the labeling and availability of pesticides for home garden use. It's a real shock to realize, if you look at the labels of chemicals that are being applied in the fields, in there it has three warnings. Human warning, do not put in the water, do not use when bees are around or flowers are blooming. If you go and buy the exact same compound in your home and garden store, the only warning that's there is the human warning. There's nothing to tell the public that what they are applying is very toxic to bees. And I know from my own family, if a little dab will do you, why not use a whole lot more? So they're applying much more of the pesticide out there. So we need to try to change this somehow and put pressure on it. Also, we need to actively educate the public. So I know from the past year that this is a major interest. We need to tell them about how to use pesticides responsibly, plant more pollinator-friendly gardens, and then also support their local beekeepers, keep them in business. So what's at stake? The bees disappear. Our foods that are pollinated here are going to disappear, and as one of my colleagues said, we'll be ending up eating gruel, i.e. oatmeal. He's Canadian. But basically, that's it. We'd have grains, and that would be it. And so, see if it works here. We'd be like Oliver Twist here, saying, more please, sir. So I'd like to do my encouragement here that we all need to become pollinator activists. So thanks.